Lecture 35, Ancient Egyptian Magic.
Hello, I'm glad you're back. Last time we talked about the end of a dynasty, and we saw Ramses III as the last great pharaoh of that dynasty, but even in his reign, if you'll remember, they tried to kill him by magic. Magic was so central to the ancient Egyptian world that I want to take a little bit of a chronological detour today. I want to not continue chronologically through the pharaohs, but I want to talk just about magic and what magic was to the Egyptians. Now, I'll try to do a couple of things. One is very hard, and that's I want to try to distinguish between magic and religion. Not easy. And the other thing I'll do is I will show you the different aspects of magic, how it had to have a spell, how there was a ritual, and how there was a magician. And you sort of needed all three to make it work. Right? But let me ask you to go back to almost our first lecture. Remember where I tried to make the distinction between the kinds of thoughts that the Egyptians had? And that there was mythology, which was stories that you're supposed to listen to, not take literally, but there's some deep message. Mythology tries to answer questions like, how did the world begin? Is there life after death? And then there was religion, which also tries to answer those very same questions. Life after death, creation. But it did in a different way. It didn't do tales that you're not supposed to believe. It tells you stories that take place in historical time, like the Exodus. So religion and mythology are quite different. One is not to be believed literally. The other is supposed to really believe it. And then it was philosophy. I even mentioned philosophy as a third and tried to make the distinction there. Philosophy tries to answer the same questions. Is there life after death? How did the world begin? But it does it in a different way, with logic. It requires proof. In religion, you just need belief. You can say, I believe in that, and that ends it. But in philosophy, we have to supply more of a story. So I tried to make those distinctions to see, what did the Egyptians do? Did they do philosophy? Did they do religion? Did they do mythology? I think the answer up to this point is, they certainly had plenty of mythology. That we know. They certainly had religion. Plenty of gods. But philosophy, we haven't seen any real papyri that are really philosophical in the sense that we mean it today. So maybe they really didn't do philosophy. But that's a story for another day. Now I want to try to do something similar, delineate magic from religion. Now, let's start with what they have in common, okay? I think magic and religion both involve the supernatural. Now, what do I mean by the supernatural? What I mean is they each try to deal with things that are beyond the laws of physics. Now, today in modern terms, you know, what would you class all this as in modern scientific jargon? Parapsychology. Parapsychology is a science that studies things like ESP, precognition, things like that. Well, all of those things, and if you look at the definition of parapsychology, it's parapsychology studies those things that are beyond the laws of physics. So in other words, if the laws of physics can't explain it, then parapsychology studies it. I think it's the same with religion and magic. Both religion and magic involve phenomena that go beyond the laws of physics. Like, for example, the parting of the Sea of Reeds in the Exodus. I think in religion, the word we would most use for those phenomena that go beyond the laws of physics, miracles. That's what a miracle is. It's something beyond the laws of physics. Same with magic. You know, if you've got a magician really pulling a rabbit out of a hat, it's beyond the laws of physics. But there's got to be a difference between the two of them. I mean, we do sense there's a difference. I think everybody feels that religion is different from magic. And I want to try, and I say it's very hard, to make that distinction. First, let me give you one difference, at least, that I think is different. In magic, you always have a goal. You always do magic, say a spell, perform a ritual, with a particular end in sight. You want to bring something about. But in prayer, I think it's possible just to pray for the sake of praying. You don't have to pray for something. You simply can pray. So I think one difference is magic is always goal-oriented. Religion isn't. You can simply believe. Now, I think there's another distinction, and this is the hard one, very hard to make. I think the difference between a magician and a priest is that the magician, when he brings about the result, you know, he's got his cape, he's got his whatever, and when he brings about the result, he's doing it. He is the one who pulls it off. But the priest never says, look what I'm going to do. I'm going to heal you. No. The priest is the intermediary between the God and the person in the church. So I think that another distinction is magic is more immediate. The magician is saying, I'm doing it. Whereas the priest, the religious person, it's the gods doing it. So always in religion we have gods, whereas in magic we don't necessarily have gods. Right? Now, the Egyptians, of course, were up to the neck in magic. Right? They did magic and religion. And it's harder for them to make that distinction between magic and religion. Let me give you an example that will sort of almost argue against what I've said, but I think what I said is right. The Egyptians had a goddess of magic. Now, I've just said the magician does it on his own, you know. But somehow there is a goddess of magic. Heka was her name. Usually, by the way, the gods who are associated with magic are women. Heka is the goddess of magic. There's also Isis, who had tremendous powers. If you remember, she raises Osiris from the dead even. And she has the title, She Who Knows Everyone's Name. And the idea was that if you knew a person's name, you could work magic against him. So the ultimate is if you know everyone's name, you got it. There's even a story of how Isis got her power over the god Re, where the god Re was, he was sick, he was dying. And she was going to help him, but he said, tell me your name. And he gives her a name, but that's not his, she tries the magic, it doesn't work. It's not his real name. See, Egyptians, if you remember, often had two names. One was the name by which everybody knew him, Imhotep. But then there was your real name, which only your mother knew. Because then if somebody tried to do a magical spell on you and they used Imhotep, but that's not your real name is Harry, then the magic wouldn't work. So there was a secret name. So Isis learns the secret name of Re and thereby gets power over him. So her name is She Who Knows Everyone's Name. Power is in knowing the name, so you can say the words. So there are goddesses and gods associated with magic, but I think there is this distinction that the magician is really pulling it about, pulling it off, and I think in religion it's an intermediary. But let's see what the parts of a magical outcome involve. First, there's the spell. Words that are spoken. And let me emphasize, and I think this is important, there's a tendency to think that magic is just any mumbo-jumbo that any magician wants to say. No. There were basic principles of magic. In the same way, you may not believe in astrology today. You may not believe in astrology. But certainly, there is a right and a wrong way to do astrology. Correct ways to draw charts. Correct ways to plot the heavens. It may not be efficacious. It may not work. But there's a right and a wrong way. There's a logic to it. And it's the same with magic. So in magic, one of the basic principles is the word is the deed. In other words, if you say it under the right conditions, it will become so. If I say, oh, may I live forever, it might happen if I say it under the right conditions. So the word is the deed is a basic principle, and that's why the spell is so important. Next element of magic, the ritual. It's a little bit like theater. There is some performance involved in magic that makes it work. Sometimes, for example, it might be drawing a protective circle on the ground. Remember the Pharaoh's name is written in a cartouche, that oval, that magically encircles his name. Encircling was very important, crucial concept to the Egyptians. And for example, a magical spell to make sure, now remember, scorpions were a real fear in ancient Egypt. There were plenty of scorpions. And there are today. I mean, if you stay in some of the smaller rest houses on the west bank of the Nile, everybody knows the first thing you do is you dump your shoes out upside down to make sure if there's any scorpion crawled in there, it gets out. And also, if you're going into a tomb that people haven't been in a while, you get that flashlight and you look for scorpions. So scorpions were a real problem. And there were spells to make sure that you wouldn't be bitten at night as you slept. And what did you do? Well, there is a spell. You say, oh, scorpion, you know, bite not me, you know, that kind of thing. But important is you took, or the magician took, his wand. And there were magical wands in ancient Egypt. Plenty of them. We still have them. They're kind of in the shape and about the size of a large boomerang. That's how they worked in ancient Egypt. And they were usually made of bone or ivory and had magical carvings on them. And if you wanted to make sure that the spell worked against scorpions, the magician would take his wand, and as he's reciting the spell, he would draw it around your bed in the dirt, so you'd have a circle protecting you, right? So that's a kind of ritual. Next, the magician. He's the third element. You can't just find the magician's wand and necessarily make it work. You can't just say the words. The magician has to be a special person. In a sense, he's a hero. He is controlling the forces of nature. Now, often, magicians came from temples, and this is where it gets hard to separate a magician from a priest. Often magicians were indeed priests also. But somehow it seemed like they could do magic also, rather than just asking the gods. For example, if you remember, in the Old Testament, when Pharaoh calls for his magicians, the word that is used, remember, in Coptic, the late form of Egyptian, and in the Coptic Bible, which still exists today, is Seshbarach. That's the word for magician in Coptic. Now, what does that mean? Sesh was scribe, Per was house, Ankh was life. These were scribes of the house of life. These were priests who were sort of schooled in this kind of thing, in the house of life, which was a school associated with the temple. Even today, we have the tradition in Egypt of there being schools attached to temples, to mosques. They're called madrasas. Right? Next to the mosque is a place of learning. So the magician was a special person, sometimes a priest, but sometimes he was a layman. I think very often, in the rural areas where there were no large temples, no books available to look up things, then I think you got laymen filling in this role. And these were like, in a sense, the country doctors who did everything. And even one further removed, we just had a midwife who did everything. These were the magicians who sort of made it up as they went along. Maybe not really schooled that well, but they could do it, right? So you have three basic elements in any magical performance. You have the spell, the word spoken. You have the ritual, some performance. And you have the magician, some special person. Now, magical practices differed considerably depending upon the outcome desired. Let me tell you about one element of magic that is so common to Egyptologists. We find these things all the time. And they're just wonderful little things. They're magical servant statues. You'll remember, of course, that the Egyptians were resurrectionists. They believed that in the next world they were literally going to get up and go again and work. Now, they viewed the next world as a continuation of this one. It was going to be basically the same. You know, so bring your tennis racket, whatever. You bring everything you could. Now, because Egypt was mainly agrarian, a farming country, they viewed the next world as a place where there's going to be a lot of farming. There were going to be the Elysian fields, so to speak. There were going to be fields where you farmed. And if you look on tomb walls, you very often see these scenes of people farming in the fields of the next world. And it's very much like this world, this plow. There might be an ox pulling the plow. But you know, the people are always dressed up in their finest linens. You know, it's kind of like, it's going to be like this world, but it's air conditioned. You get that feeling that it's kind of like, it's better, believe me. Now, Egypt, as you know, had strong centralized government, which is what it made it great, right from the time of Narmer. And one of the things that made Egypt great was they could focus all their manpower on irrigation canals. They could bring the Nile water in and irrigate more land than you might expect. And this was a kind of communal work project. When inundation came, they had to have those irrigation channels ready. And the pharaoh could say, you know, the astronomer priest would say, well, it's July, the Nile is going to rise very soon, we better get these canals ready. And they would call upon the population of Egypt, all the farmers, and put them where they were needed. You're going to dig this canal, you're going over there, you're going over there. It was kind of by fiat. And I think the ancient Egyptians, when they thought about the next world, figured that this was going to happen in the next world. They were going to be called upon to do farm labor. But the next world was going to be better. How? Servant statues. You could have statues made and placed in your tomb. And these statues are called Ushabti. It's an ancient Egyptian word, and it means answerer, from the verb Wesheb, to answer. W and U is the same, so it's Wesheb or Usheb. Ushabti's meaning, I'm answering. These little statues, when you were called in the next world to do work, this little statue would say, here I am, and it would get up and work for you. Now, many, many Egyptians were buried with 365 of these statues, one for each day of the year. Right? They were sort of like union or shop. They only worked one day a year, and they would work when called. Right? And they are lovely little figures. And the kind of statues you had depended upon what you could afford. Some of them are beautiful works of art, made out of faience, which is a quartzite paste, a paste, remember, that is fired in a kiln and glazes itself, so it can be green or blue, and they're rather beautiful. And usually the Ushabti, the little figure, the little servant statue, has two or three characteristics that you know right away, ah, this is a servant statue. One is, the legs are together, it's a standing figure, because he's wrapped like a mummy. It's associated with Osiris, because it's going to be in the land of the dead. But also, the hands are crossed, across the chest, and in the hands are farm implements. These guys are going to work in the next world. Sometimes, on the Ushabtis that are very, very carefully done, over the back of the shoulder is a seed pack. You can see it. It's a little straw pack slung over the shoulder that these guys are going to go through the fields and throw out the seeds in the next world. So these Ushabti statues are everywhere. And 365, if you were really wealthy, Tutankhamun had more than 400. And every one was an individual, beautiful portrait of Tutankhamun, the face. They're spectacular. Let me tell you a little detail, a kind of almost Disney trivia, but it's really Egyptological trivia, about, do you know where in a Walt Disney film you see Ushabtis? The very first movie I ever saw was Fantasia. Now, I don't know if you remember Fantasia. It's the one where it's a cartoon, of course, and there's a sequence in Fantasia. Mostly fantastic things happen in Fantasia. That's why it's called that. But there's a sequence called The Sorcerer's Apprentice where Mickey Mouse has a sorcerer's hat on, a kind of sorcerer-type cloak, and he teaches a broomstick to fetch water. And if you remember, it gets out of hand. The broomstick won't stop fetching the water. And he takes an axe and slices the broomstick in half. And now you've got two of them fetching water. And that's a da-dump, da-dump, da-dump. That is an ancient Egyptian story. That is from an ancient Egyptian papyrus about a magician who tries to train a broomstick to do this. Right? It's pure Egyptian. Pure Egyptian. Now, why is this Mickey Mouse fetching water also? On every Ushabti statue, if you were wealthy, if you had a big enough one that could hold an inscription, is a magical spell. And it's part of the Book of the Dead, even, because if you couldn't afford Ushabti, you could maybe have a piece of paper that would do it, hopefully. It's a spell from the Book of the Dead, which says, basically, if I am called to do work in the next world, answer, here I am. If I am called to haul sand from the east to the west, do my bidding. If I am called to work in the fields, answer, here I am. and then the name of the deceased. So the Yashapti would know, oh, your name's Amenhotep. So if I hear Amenhotep at the corvée when the people are called to work, I will pop up and do the work. So these Yashapti statues became a central part of Egyptian culture. There were whole factories that made these, cranking them out of molds. And you know, it's neat. I mean, they really thought the next world was going to be like this one. For every 10 Yashaptis you had an overseer Yashapti to make sure they worked. And the overseer Yashapti, you can tell, is different. He has a starched kilt on. And the starched kilt was a sign that I don't have to do manual labor. I mean, with that starched kilt, you can't do anything. You can't move around. It's, you know, like a miniskirt, practically. And the idea is to make sure that these 10 guys do it, you got an overseer for each 10. And when you went to your tomb, they were packed very neatly in boxes, little Yashapti boxes. So this is a bit of magic that everybody wanted. If you were real poor, you couldn't afford these big, beautiful faience or Yashapti statues. No. They would be made out of perhaps terracotta. And somebody in your house, maybe somebody's taking an art class, so to speak, you know, an amateur artist, would fashion these little things. And sometimes they look practically like crude cigarettes that look so poorly done. But you would be buried with these in the hope that they would serve you in the next world. So this is only one little facet of magic, but it became a major industry in ancient Egypt, an essential regalia for the next world. Now, there were also statues that were called oracle statues. And these were really interesting things. Now, they were statues of the gods, right? But these statues could supposedly talk. Now, we've never found one that we think is an oracle statue. But, you know, what you might think is, for example, like they're a little bit like maybe a mannequin almost, a puppet where the jaw might drop open and close. We never found anything like that. But these oracle statues were central to the culture again. There is actually a papyrus that records the case of an oracle statue who solved a crime. Some watchman was sleeping on the job at the warehouse, and some shirts were stolen while he was sleeping. And the question was, who took it? Now, when you went to court in ancient Egypt, you could do two things. You could go before real people, a court with judges. Now, the judges were usually, by the way, elders of the village. There were no lawyers in ancient Egypt. There was no concept that you needed somebody to speak for yourself. You presented your case, the other side presented its, and the elders would decide. But if you didn't want to take that route, the sort of, I guess, traditional judicial route, you could go to an oracle statue, and its decision was binding. And this watchman, who thought he knew who stole the shirts, went before an oracle. And we're told, he said, so-and-so stole the shirts. And the other guy came, and he said, I didn't steal the shirts. And the oracle nodded or indicated in some way this guy did steal the shirts. Now, you're allowed a second hearing, right? You could appeal. And they went to another oracle statue. And this watchman who had slept on the job started reading the names of the people in the village. And when it got to the name of this guy he had accused, the oracle indicated, yep, that's the guy. And this guy was convicted. So oracle statues could in some way speak, and they have legal weight. Quite interesting. But I think the bit of magic that dominates Egyptian life more than anything is amulets, magical amulets. This was something everybody could afford. Now, let me define for you what an amulet is. It is a small object worn for protection. That, by the way, is the ancient Egyptian etymology of the word. Originally, these things were called things like protectors, right? And there were many amulets. Different amulets for different goals intended. For example, the Eye of Horus. Now, the Eye of Horus was, I think, one of the most popular of all amulets. It was a small thing, worn around the neck usually, you know, maybe an inch or so. And it represented the eye of the falcon god Horus. Now, why was that such an important magical amulet? If you'll remember, Horus did battle with Seth, his evil uncle. And he tried to kill him, but he didn't. But he beats him up. But in the battle, Horus's eye is taken out. Now, the eye was magically regenerated by the god Thoth, god of writing, also god of magic. So the eye is magically regenerated, and it became the sign of health. And it represents the very very sort of characteristic markings of a falcon's eye. If you look in a museum more than any place, a natural history museum at a falcon, you'll see the parts of the eye are really carefully reproduced in this magical amulet. And I'll tell you something that we get today that people do not realize from the eye of Horus. A symbol that every one of you knows that became a sign of health. The pharmacist's Rx. As in prescription, the pharmacist's Rx is really a corruption of part of the eye of Horus, part of the elements of the eye of Horus. Now, if you know Latin, Rx doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. The eye of Horus in the Middle Ages became a kind of sign of health, and that was corrupted eventually by the apothecaries to be the Rx. So the eye of Horus becomes our symbol of health also. So if you want to be healthy, the eye of Horus was worn. And if you remember last time, we were talking about the grave robbers and that they took the eye of Horus amulets from the bodies of the kings. These were things that were worn both by the living and by the deceased. Now, the most common of all magical amulets was the scarab. That was the one. We find literally thousands of them. Thousands. That and the eye of Horus are the two that we find all the time. Now, the scarab is a carved beetle. It's carved in the shape of a beetle. And remember, if you remember, I mentioned it once before. The word for beetle was a pun. In ancient Egyptian, it was pronounced cheper, cheper. That meant two things. One, it meant beetle. But the other meant to exist. So if you wore a beetle around your neck, you would exist. It was for continued existence. So that's an important one. One other thing about the scarab, by the way, why the Egyptians were so interested in scarabs and beetles? It had to do with a little bit of bad biology. Egyptians weren't great on biology, really, by any means. They believed that the scarab procreated without a male and female. They thought that there was only a female, or maybe only a male. The reason is, they saw the scarab, the beetle, the actual beetle, it's a dung beetle, and it's called Scarabaeus sacer. That's the Latin name, and that's why we get scarab, from Scarabaeus sacer, the sacred scarab, the sacred beetle. They saw scarabs pushing their dung balls in front of them. Now, the female lays the eggs in a dung ball so that they'll have food when they hatch, right? The eggs of the young. And they saw him pushing this thing, and it looked like the sun, this large disk being rolled across the horizon. And because they thought there wasn't a male and female, and they never caught him at it, but because they thought male and female, they thought this was a very special animal. So the scarab became sacred. So scarabs are another thing that the Egyptians loved to wear. They also used them as signet rings. On the bottom of the scarab, the flat part, you would carve your name, and you could seal your wine jar so the servants couldn't get into it. You would put a little clay at the top and seal it. So another important aspect were these magical amulets. Another one that I think is really surprising is the magical amulet that everybody knows about today. People wear them. I see people wear them all the time. The Ankh, the cross, the Egyptian cross that means life, right? It's a loop on top and then a regular cross, two arms going across and down. The surprising thing is the Ankh is perhaps the rarest of all amulets. We never find them. Never find them in excavations. We always see gods painted on temples holding them and touching it to the nose of the pharaoh, giving him life. But I think this may have been something reserved to the gods, because very rare as an amulet. Now, another one is solely for the dead, as I mentioned. Some are for the living, some are for the dead. Another one is called the Dejed pillar. This is a little amulet usually, and it's carved, it looks like a pillar, with some lines across it. And what it represents is the backbone of the god Osiris. And if you wore this, you'd have stability. Right, because the backbone is what gives you stability. The lines across, I think, really represent vertebra going across. Now, for amulets, though, it wasn't just the shape. No. The material you made the amulet out of was important. That had magical properties also. For example, the backbone of Osiris, the Dejed pillar, it was best if it was carved out of bone, because Osiris's real backbone was bone, of course. So the idea is that as close as you can come to the association, make it look like the backbone, make it out of the same material, then maybe it'll work. Also important for many of these amulets was color. I think very often for the Egyptians, very often, that they were just as interested in the color as the material. For example, sometimes red would represent blood. And the knot of Isis, a knot that she used to tie her garment with, always had to be red. Something to do with blood. Right? So it's not just the amulet itself. It's the color and the material. But magic was just absolutely essential to the ancient Egyptian worldview. Crucial. Now, with this detour away from chronological history, next time we'll go back and we'll try to trace the history of Egypt, which we saw was slipping away. I'll see you then.